Think about how often you find yourself in a group with people with different political views and how often you draw yourself up and make an impassioned statement in defense of the facts. Yeah, that was a bit of a joke. We know that people often avoid political discussions like the plague because other people just don't seem to be willing to change their minds, especially because of a debate. So why do they change their minds? Philosopher Eleanor Gordon Smith takes up that question in the book, Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. Eleanor Gordon Smith has a voice that may sound familiar to public radio listeners. Her work has appeared on This American Life, among other outlets. Eleanor is a broadcaster and writer focused on the intersection of academic ethics and human life, the chaos of human life, says her bio. Eleanor Gordon Smith, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
You mentioned you were a champion debater in school, but you met your match in a piece for This American Life 3 years ago. What did you try to do?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really strange process for me. I did meet my match. I wasn't expecting to meet my match, and I met my match in some surprising ways. So the origin of the piece for This American Life was pretty simple. The idea was that I was going to go out onto the streets of Sydney in Australia, where I'm from, and just kind of wait to be catcalled, just wait for the usual onslaught of street harassment and, you know, crude remarks and slightly crass vulgar jokes. And instead of doing what I usually do, which is to kind of play my part and sort of not break the fourth wall, to not turn around and acknowledge that this has happened in any way, instead I realized that that this was an opportunity to kind of put some of these debating skills to work, or at least that's what I thought. So the idea for the radio program was, why don't I just take a recorder and a microphone and go out and wait to be catcalled and then turn around and say, you know, what did you just say? What were you hoping for when you said it? And more importantly, what could I say that would make you change your mind about it? What could I say to make you think, I'm not going to do this anymore? And that wound up sort of taking somewhere between 6 to 8 weeks, where every single night I would go out and have these conversations with these men. And every single night I encountered this bizarre thing where I would make the argument, you know, I would marshal the facts, I would give what I thought was a kind of compelling reasoned case, something to the effect of, you know, do you think it matters to you whether women like it? And they'd say, yeah, I really want it to be fun. I want her to be enjoying herself as well. And I'd say, well, take it from me, they're not enjoying it. And they'd say, we can't speak for all women. And this would just go back and forth and back and forth for like hours. I would stand talking to these guys in the street. And at the end of that experiment, I wound up talking to this one guy named Zach for more than 3 hours cumulatively, once with a friend of his and once later alone. And after 3 hours of what wound up being a kind of oddly intimate, quite surprising, quite candid conversation, I was at best able to persuade him to stop slapping women in the street, which is something that he'd said that he did from time to time. But I wasn't able to persuade him to stop actually catcalling. That was something that he said he was still going to do.
Slapping them on the rear end, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. No. Sorry. Not slapping them in the face. That would be overly confrontational. No. He said that a strategy that he used to kind of get women's attention or to try to be cheeky was, as you say, to slap them on their rear end. Although he used a more crude term.
So it's understandable why you write that you felt deflated after putting the piece together for American Life. But what was the response to it?
Well, so this was what was really strange to me was I mean, deflated is the right word. I was really pessimistic all of a sudden about whether the strategies that I had put so much faith in, you know, strategies about just talking to each other, I was really concerned that those strategies were not, after all, going to be able to bring us closer to the truth. But then the piece went to air, and I was inundated with hundreds of emails, hundreds of phone calls, I think maybe even thousands of emails, basically all offering me congratulations for the successful use of like rational persuasion in public. So someone offered to give me an award for how well I'd persuaded these guys. People asked me to come and teach seminars about harassment in the workplace. People commended me on my use of calm, logical argument in the face of such irrationality. And the thing that was really weird about this was that I didn't think that I'd done my job. You know, I didn't think that I'd succeeded. And it was this bizarre sort of Rorschach blot moment where I felt like I was looking at the conversations in that episode and hearing, you know, someone who was trying but ultimately failing to change people's minds, and other people on the other ends of their radios were hearing those same conversations but hearing them as an example of persuasive success. And that was very peculiar to me.
So the point of the book ends up being, and of course the title is Stop Being Reasonable, that the approach isn't necessarily working for the people upon whom you want it to work. So, I mean, you had believed in rational discourse and debating and pounding people with the facts, but have you gotten to the conclusion that those are the things that don't work?
Well, it's a little more complicated or unpredictable than that. I think the thing that it made me realize was twofold. One was just a pragmatic point, namely these strategies are kind of exhausting and they don't work as reliably as we might like them to, given how much energy we pour into them. But the second point was a sort of broader philosophical point, because in my day job, I'm a philosopher. And the zoomed out sort of thing that started to occur to me as I started thinking about what had happened for me in this incident was, given that we all kind of already know that these strategies don't work, like most of us have had an experience like the one I had in those streets. Most of us have given what we think is a really rational argument and just totally failed to get a foothold in someone else's thinking. Given that we all basically have that misgiving about how rational argument works, why are we still so convinced that it's the right way to go about it? And I don't mean right pragmatically. I mean, we think there's something kind of like noble or worth aspiring to or something like ethically good about the ideal of just talking to each other more. And I started thinking like, well, why? Like if it's failed us so many times, if we know that there are other and better ways of changing people's minds that are more sort of humane or idiosyncratic or something, why aren't we more interested in asking how we should change our minds instead of just how we do?
So we'll pick up with the six stories that help demonstrate that people didn't change their minds because they were met with great sets of facts. We'll come back to the discussion with Eleanor Gordon-Smith about her book, Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a little more than a minute and a half. On the way to the break, I'll remind you it's Fall Fund Drive, the next to last day of that Fall Fund Drive here on JPR. We're seeking your pledges of support to keep programs like this on the air. 888-552-6191 and IJPR. .org for your pledges. Thank you. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the philosopher, writer, and broadcaster Eleanor Gordon-Smith, who has taken a look at how people try to change each other's minds and found the current general approach somewhat lacking, to put it mildly. Her book is called Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we explore the stories of six people who did change their minds and how. The point of the conversation and your welcomeness to it is at our website. Wait a minute. What am I saying here? Join the conversation on the Exchange. Pardon the word salad. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Eleanor, it's not just that you say that the approach isn't working. You say that now you think our views about how to change minds is not just wrong, but also bad for us.
Yeah, it sounds bold when you put it like that, but I guess I put it like that. That's in the introduction. I think that where I wound up after engaging with this project for a couple of years now, and after writing the book and speaking to a whole bunch of people who've changed their minds in really quite surprising and high-stakes ways, is that the way that we construct so much of, you know, rational discourse or public debate is based around this idea that if we just speak to each other and bring each other the facts, that we'll be able to bring each other closer to the truth. And we put like a lot of faith in this. We put a lot of like TV time and broadcast money and sponsorship, and we give it a lot of our leisure hours when we sit down to watch people having these kinds of debates. And I think that a lot of us feel this kind of stagnancy or this stalemate or a sense of frustration with that model. And I think the reason I say that it's bad for us to keep kind of trading on this idea of how rational discourse works is that I think that that is a kind of distraction from the ways that we might actually be able to change people's minds. So, you know, I think we look around right now and we have a lot of people who have a lot of energy towards wanting to change people's minds. People have the kind of inclination or the impulse to try to reach other people. It feels really important at the moment. But the way that we do that is to kind of lapse back in on having more and more open conversations with people. And it's not clear to me that that's actually the best strategy. And as long as we don't know that it's the best strategy, it seems kind of curious to me that we keep pouring effort and energy into the same thing.
Well, and you point out, too, that we give platforms to racist, sexist, and science-denying speakers to, quote-unquote, challenge them. And you find a problem with that, too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find a problem with it just unto itself. I think that, in fact, one of the things that that I have pulled out of writing this book and out of the project is that I am ultimately more optimistic than I once was about our ability to change our minds. I think that it can happen. I think people can have these moments of dramatic overhaul. But I think that the speed with which we have these kinds of debates with people, like the ones you just mentioned, like racist and sexist and science-denying people, that speed is kind of worrying to me. So I would want us to be a lot more confident that simply having conversations with these people is going to have the effect that we want. And the reason I would want us to have that more confidence is that putting people with views like that onto public platforms comes with costs. And it might be the case that those costs are worth bearing. You know, it might be the case that even though we know that hearing views like this makes people more likely to adopt them, and even though we know that having conversations with people of rival views can often just empower them, you know, we might think, like, look, that's a cost worth bearing, because ultimately this model of debate is going to help us and it's going to be what brings us closer to the truth. But I don't feel like we know that. I feel like the jury is sort of out on whether that system is going to be the one that saves us. And so in the intervening time, while we're still uncertain, it's not clear to me that those costs are worth bearing.
Before we get to the stories of people who did change their minds, we come back in the book to the earlier incident we talked about, where you talked to people on the streets in Sydney, where you're from, about two guys who catcall women, who smack them in the rear end in some cases, and whistle at them, all sorts of things. So to a man, do they think that women like the catcalls and whistles and all that?
Yeah, they do. This was what was so surprising to me about it. It was like a revelation for me when I realized this. And partly when I went out to try to have these conversations, I genuinely was motivated by curiosity. You know, it was one of these things that just for me, I have these moments now and then where I look at a sort of a certain social practice and I just feel like I'm on the outside of a fishbowl, like beating on the glass, trying to understand what's going on for other people. This was one of those moments. Like I've never understood what could motivate someone to want to shout something at a woman on the street, particularly things like men will shout stuff like out of a moving car. It's like, well, I can't, you're never going to see me again. Like this it's not even plausible that you're stopping to like try to get my number or have anything like flirtatious happen because you've sailed away before you've even finished saying the thing. So I was genuinely baffled, like what is it that motivates people? And I found out when I actually got down to, you know, sincerely asking, why do you like this? Why is this fun for you? That every single one of these men would say something about how they felt like they were giving women a good time. So for some of them, it was flirtatious. It was like, oh, she's going to feel pretty or she's going to feel, you know, more confident because of what I've said. Others just thought it was funny. But yeah, to a man, every single one of them felt like what they were doing was, I guess, like a street party, or one of the men compared it to like being a paradise bird, you know, just like doing these magnificent shows of
strutting.
Bravado and exactly, strutting, yeah. And I was astonished by that. It was one of those moments where something so profoundly like bedrock is, because of the fact that it's bedrock, totally invisible to you.
Eleanor Gordon-Smith is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. So here's where we get into with this discussion of with the men who did the catcalls on Sydney streets. Get into credibility presumptions. And your view evidently was discounted because you're a woman.
That's the view that I ultimately came to. And this is something that I was better able to spot because of my work in philosophy. So this is something that I was able to diagnose because of the work of, you know, feminist thinkers in recent years who have done work to try to analyze the ways that credibility and the way that we believe people is subject to the same kind of distributions of power that everything else is subject to. You know, it's not surprising, but, you know, nonetheless, it's somehow manages to surprise us. It's not surprising that certain sorts of people, typically those who are, you know, female or people of color or people who are otherwise disadvantaged, tend to be not believed at the same rate as people from more dominant groups. And what that means is, while it's all very well to say, you know, the free and fair exchange of ideas is what will allow you to have your point heard, actually it's totally possible for certain sorts of people to turn up in this gladiatorial arena, you know, armed with their words and armed with their argument, and then find that actually their weapons and their tools have been kind of blunted by the fact of who they are. So you can stand there and make a perfectly good argument, make a perfectly well-reasoned case. But because of the fact that you are the one who's making it, your words arrive to other people's ears with considerably less significance than they would if you were a different sort of person.
And as you phrase it, these words practically smoke. They're burning so much in the book. Words do not work the same way for everyone, which then raises the question, how does a person begin to claim a power that the other party does not grant willingly?
Yeah, this is a profoundly vexing philosophical problem. This is something that I think is a really urgent thing. It bothers me a great deal. I think there's no simple answer to how we can kind of wrest back some of that power, except one thing that I think it's really helpful to have, and that I hope that the book provides, at least in that introductory section, is a diagnosis for why it can feel so frustrating to just kind of fail to make progress. Because if you don't have that diagnosis in hand, you know, if you keep having this experience of speaking to people and not being heard, it's really easy for you to feel like, well, I'm the problem. You know, it was very easy for me when I was speaking to these catcallers to just go home night after night and feel like, oh, if I'd made the right case, if I'd found the right argument, if I'd come up with a slightly better example, then it would have been totally different. And it's my fault, you know, it's a failure of my reasoning that they haven't seen what I say to be the truth. And once you understand that, in fact, you know, that words don't work the same way for everyone, then at minimum, while we think about how to solve that, we can at least take some of the burden off our own shoulders and start to feel like maybe some of these persuasive stalemates that we find ourselves in aren't as our fault as we might have thought.
Eleanor Gordon Smith, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, philosopher, broadcaster, writer. Her book is called Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. It features six stories of people who got into certain life circumstances that led them to change their minds. We'll get into those in just a moment. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. The next story is of a guy from a religious sect and the woman who wanted to get him out. Now, some of her family had been in the same sect. What does that say about the kinds of romantic partners we gravitate to?
Isn't it interesting? Yeah. I think there's something really surprising about this. Except I think that in actual fact, the fact that her partner was a member of this sect was as much a surprise to her as it was to me when I heard this story. I don't know whether it was something that she gravitated towards in a sort of Freudian repetition of the thing that she'd already known. Although, you know, it's totally plausible that it would have been. It's totally plausible the fact that she had such a terrible experience with this sect previously might have led her to feel more urgently than other people how important it is to try to get people out.
Yeah, the idea of trying to fix the stuff from your childhood with the person you choose for a life partner
is
certainly tied up in there. But, you know, belief itself is examined here. I would expect no less of a philosopher. But how often do we ask ourselves how we know what we know?
Right. This is such a foundational question. And this is a big part of what kind of motivated me to embark on this particular kind of inquiry was, you know, I said a little earlier that I think there's one question, which is like, how do we change our minds just pragmatically? And there's another question, which is, I think, an even richer question, namely, like, how should we change our minds? And when we ask how should we change our minds, we're asking something pretty deeply philosophical, namely, not just why do we think what we think, but on what grounds is it right to think anything? And something really vivid to me about this story about this man who left the sect is that when you hear about people who had, you know, I mean, I don't want to be disparaging, but kind of peculiar or like outlandish or apocalyptic religious beliefs, it's really tempting to look at them and to think that the problem was something that they did something wrong in the way that they formulated their beliefs. And the really common diagnosis is simply, you know, they were too credulous. They were too quick to believe what other people told them. They were surrounded by religious figures who served them a version of the universe on a platter. And instead of interrogating it or questioning it, like, you know, an inverted commas sensible person would, they just believed it. And that's a vice. And so in some way, it's on them that they wound up believing this terrible thing. But the thing I argue in the book and the insight that I had from speaking to these people for so long is that, you know, actually very often we believe things simply because we've been told them. Like right now, like your listeners will believe that I in fact spoke to these people.
Right.
You know, that's a belief that you take more or less on faith. And that's something we do all the time. You know, if I go out on the street and I ask directions to a train station, I don't pause to interrogate the credentials of the person who gives me those directions. I just believe them. There are plenty of cases in ordinary life where the fact that we've been told something is a perfectly good reason to believe it. So if we want to understand what goes wrong for people like the person that I spoke to who left his sect. You know, we need to be a little bit more fine-grained in our descriptions of what it is, you know, of what kinds of grounds we can have for beliefs that are bad grounds.
Dylan is the man who left the sect. Missy is the woman who knew she loved him and wanted him out of the sect. So how did she approach that?
I think this is such a beautiful story. I think it's in many ways like a profound love story. And I think it's a neat little photo negative that Missy actually wound up doing something that was a far greater exercise of faith than anything that Dylan did while he was a believer. So the way that it worked was Missy and Dylan met at a restaurant that they were both working at. And even now when I was interviewing them, it's like genuinely a frustrating challenge as someone who's doing an interview that they just will not get out of each other's sentences. Like they are so in love and so fused as a couple that they see like speaking as a profoundly collaborative exercise. It's very irritating. And they had that kind of connection from day one. You know, this was a love connection from the minute they met. And Missy then found out that Dylan was a member of this very punitive, very isolating religious sect. And she knew that she didn't want to be married to a member of that sect. You know, this was something that she really hadn't wanted in her life. But she also knew that she wanted to be married to Dylan. So to try to square that circle, what she did was she married him, she moved in with him, she lived in his religious community, she had kids with him, she did all kinds of acts of commitment with him, all the while pretending to him that she was open to being baptized into the sect and that she might, you know, just yet be convinced to believe what they believed. And in fact, for 7 years, while she kept this face on, she was secretly planting seeds of doubt in Dylan's mind. And she was trying to call his attention to the ways that the sect was like cult-like in its structure, the way that it was very punitive towards people who dissented. She tried to raise doubts with him about whether their interpretations of scripture were correct. And this was an ongoing project for years where she just tried to chip away at his certainty. And in the end, it actually wasn't anything to do with what Missy had said that got him out of the sect. It was altogether more surprising.
So the sect is fairly secretive. It seems like it's a very rigid kind of set of beliefs. You know, if you take any of this, you take it all. There's no bits and pieces kinds of things be in other religion. It ultimately seems to have come down to who he believed, not what. So what finally got him to look up what people who left the sect said about it?
Right, you're right. I mean, so one of the elements of precisely how secretive this sect was is that they don't really have contact with people who don't believe what they believe. Such that Dylan, who had been born into this environment, had basically never had serious exposure to someone who didn't think what he thought. And he was trained from a very young age to think that seeking out apostates or trying to hear what other people might have to say was itself a punishable indication that you were sort of rank in spirit, that there was something wrong with you. So getting him to have doubt was really, you know, a big Sisyphean task. And ultimately what happened was, of all things, it was love that got him out. It was the ultimate faith, which is faith in another person. And what happened was, for reasons that are kind of complicated, he wound up in a position where one of the religious leaders said to him, "Look, you have to choose between your wife and salvation. You can't have both," because his wife Missy had for a couple of years, you know, been like a little bit bolshy and a little bit truculent and a little bit disrespectful towards some of the traditions of this particular religious sect. She always acted like she was open to it, but she never quite was fully in it. And so one of the leaders of this group came to Dylan and said, "You've got to choose. It's Missy or it's your salvation." And for Dylan, that moment forced him to reckon with the fact that his religious leaders were capable of getting something wrong, because he was so confident that his wife was a good, kind, patient, loving person that anyone who could meet her and believe that she was a threat or believe that she was a bad person was someone who could get things wrong. So all of a sudden, it wound up, you know, causing this crisis of credibility for Dylan. We were talking about credibility just a moment ago. It wound up forcing Dylan to reckon with the fact that those people could make mistakes. And if they could make mistakes about his wife, then why not make mistakes about the nature of the universe or what happens after we die or what we should do until then? And all of a sudden, he realized that all these beliefs about God and the universe and morality, he had accepted simply on their say-so, when their say-so might not have been that valuable after all.
The images, even if there are no pictures, I should point out, but just the word images of him sitting down at a computer and starting to look at places where people criticize the sect are fairly mind-boggling. I did not ask, did not think to ask, though, until just now, though, I mean, how did they raise their kids if he was in the sect and she was not really?
Well, so, I mean, the way that it worked was that she was able to kind of feign enough interest that she was begrudgingly welcomed as a member of the community. So she still lived with them. She still went to worship sessions. She still went to, you know, scripture. And their kids went to school with other believers. But she was always kind of a little like arm's length from other people. But it was difficult. It caused her a lot of consternation to be a mother in that situation.
No doubt. The book is called Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. And in this case, it really is a love story that helped change Dylan's mind about the sect he was in. Missy pried him away from it through very patient application of her own principles. We'll come back and talk more with Eleanor Gordon-Smith about her book. And you can join the conversation. As we head to the break, I'll remind you once again, we are in day 6 of a 7-day fall fun to drive here on JPR. Just crossed $65,000, so not quite halfway to our goal of $140,000. Need to pick up the pace here with more pledges of support to keep programs like the Jefferson Exchange on the air. We would love your pledge. 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. Thank you, and back on the Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Eleanor Gordon-Smith, philosopher, writer, broadcaster. You may have heard her on This American Life 3 years ago talking about one of her projects, which was to talk to people in the streets of Sydney, men who catcalled women. Why do you do this? She got into deep philosophical discussions with them and discovered she could change nobody's mind. So that set about some thinking and resulted in a book called Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. It features the 6 stories of people who did change their minds and what the circumstances were. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So next up is a British reality TV show called Faking It. What's the premise here?
This is one of the best stories in the book, in my humble view. It's one of the strangest and most delectable little stories. So Faking It was a reality TV program like years and years ago, way back in the early days of reality TV. And this was like well before, you know, the Kardashians or the Hiltons had kind of popularized this format and turned it into an exercise for fame and glamour. This was way back in early BBC days, where the big forefront of the genre was primarily British TV shows that were basically dressed up psychological experiments. They would take people and put them into slightly peculiar circumstances and just like stand back and watch. And it made for some astonishingly good TV. I'm a real devotee of this particular moment in reality TV. One of the best shows, in my view, was a show called Faking It, which is basically like My Fair Lady, but updated as contemporary. And what they would do is take someone who had a really archetypical identity, like they were just the instantiation of a certain stereotype, and then they would train them in a skill which was completely opposite to that stereotype. So they took a skinhead and they made him conduct the London Symphonic Orchestra. They took a house painter and they made him do, you know, an installation of modern conceptual art. And at the end of, you know, 6 or 4 weeks training in this particular skill, the contestant would have to pass off, you know, their expertise in that skill in front of a panel of people who genuinely were experts in that skill and who'd been doing it all their lives. And this one contestant who really stayed with me, you know, from the years since I've seen that program, his name is Alex. And Alex was like not much bigger than I am, which is like 5 foot something, very slight. He was the eldest son of an eldest son. He was a proper English aristocrat. He lives in an estate on Rolling Green Hills. You know, the line in the book is that he shows us around and introduces us to Roger, who is a horse. He's got this family who's got, you know, a long mahogany table, and they have dinner with candlesticks. He goes to Oxford and Cambridge and Eton. He's this kind of type of guy. And they took him and they trained him to be a bouncer. And not just a bouncer, but a bouncer in the middle of the European, of the 2000 European football championships.
Oh, so lots of drunk football fans.
Right, huge numbers of drunk football fans. And I think actually it was the grand final night. So he had to stand at the entrance to this massive club where, you know, scores and scores of drunk English football fans were streaming in and out and trying to, you know, get in even when they were really, really drunk. And Alex, this slight, posh, upper-class dude had to stand at the front of that club and somehow transform himself into a physical presence that would be threatening enough to get these football fans to back off. And it was no mean feat.
So, but ultimately he ended up staying in that persona or at least leaving his old one, which is a huge mind change. He essentially decided, Alex, that who he was not the real him.
It's astonishing. It's one of my most favorite delectable moments of change in this whole book. So what happens to him is that, you know, he finishes this exercise and training as a bouncer, and he gets on the train to go back home after the cameras have packed up and the producers have put their equipment away. And he's sitting on the train to go back to the green rolling hills. And he realizes, like, I'm not sure which identity I've actually been faking. Like, I don't know if I've been faking this bouncer identity or if I all along was faking the sort of, you know, aristocratic identity. And he wound up having this amazing moment of reckoning with himself where he started to change his mind about who he really was, which as a philosopher is super interesting to me because it puts him in this kind of very interesting tailspin where the only tool that he has available for changing his mind about who he really is the thing that stands to be imperiled by that investigation, right? Like, he's using his mind to change his mind about what his mind is really like. It's this amazing, like, loop-the-loop that just keeps going round and round. And he wound up, you know, really, really altering his sense of who he was. He packed a backpack. He got on a plane. He moved to Australia where he took up a job that utilized a lot of the skills that he had learned while training as a bouncer. And 20 years later, he's still there. You know, it completely changed his sense of self.
So what is it that you quote here in the book about the philosopher Peter Goldie saying about the ideal of a stable self?
Yeah, this is something that I hope that a lot of us can learn from because it's one of the most dramatic kinds of mind change that you can go through is to realize that you might have been wrong about who you really were. And for Alex, what that meant was there was a period where he just didn't have a sense of self. You know, it's not like he reasoned himself into a new one. That's why he's in a book called Stop Being Reasonable. It wasn't something he could be reasonable about. He couldn't talk himself into a better hypothesis about himself. He just kind of had to stand back and let things unfold and see where they wound up. But that's not the same as arguing yourself into a conclusion. And for him, that meant that there was this very strange period where he just didn't know what kind of person he really was. Like, he very truly didn't know who he was. And that's hugely disorienting. And, like, Nietzsche has this line, which I always think of, which is that for a temple to be built, a temple must be destroyed. And there is a space, that means, between temples, right? There's this kind of zone where everything is just dust. And Alex was in that space for a long time. But Peter Goldie, who I mentioned in the chapter, is a wonderful philosopher who's written a lot about the idea of the self and specifically the ideas of the stories we tell about ourselves. And he says basically that the ideal of a stable self might be a mistaken one, that it might be a fiction, a comforting fiction, but a fiction, that we can have this kind of continuous, stable sense of self. And that in fact, precisely in the moments where we feel nothing but chaos, those are the moments where we can kind of reach forward for something which winds up being meaningful to us and winds up having significance to us, which isn't visible at the time. Such that even though it feels terribly painful and like a fracture and like a break, that chaos may be the very thing where an even truer self is ultimately forged.
Well, yeah, you're tested, so you find out who you really are is the essence of what we're talking about there.
Exactly.
So it seems like the best con artists and dictators make great use of the self-doubt that a lot of people have.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing that I think we would do well to reflect on, is that a lot of the ways that we structure our public discourse is around the idea that we will be able to just make sense of good arguments. And what that leaves out is all the personal baggage that we bring to our role as the listeners of good arguments. And, you know, that means that we bring things like self-doubt or confusion or a need for belonging or an old sense of hurt that we want someone to address. And all those things go into what we believe, and they leave us open to being manipulated and leveraged in ways that we might want to be better attuned to.
So then how do we approach other people then? I mean, what can we take away from the book in a world where there's a good chance that if we approach somebody who disagrees with us on something, particularly political things, there's a good chance they won't listen to what we have to say, and there's a, you know, better than even chance that we'll return the favor?
Yeah, that's an elegant way of putting it, yeah. I think, look, I mean, I got two things out of the process of writing this book. One is that I got a fair amount of optimism. So So it's quite difficult to spend 2.5 years, as I have now, interviewing people who change their minds in these really dramatic ways and hearing their stories and their kind of their courage and their optimism and the way that they were able to push forward out of these moments of chaos. It's very hard to do that and to still feel pessimistic about our chances of changing each other's minds. Like, I do think it's possible. I've seen it happen. I've spent time with the people that it happened for. I think that it's a really beautiful but also very strange and very idiosyncratic process. But I'm confident. I'm absolutely confident that it can happen. So thing one, I think, is to just, like, retain a certain amount of hope and optimism. But the second thing, which is maybe more concretely useful to answer your question about how do we literally approach people, is that the thing that I've realized in speaking to all these people is just how unmappable and peculiar these processes are. You know, it was never the case that someone just heard an argument and then a switch flipped and they didn't have the relevant belief anymore. It always involved this strange, personal, idiosyncratic kind of period of gestation where this idea had to sit with them for quite a long time before it could come forth into anything like a full belief. And I think very often when we come to someone who we want to talk to or who we want to reason with, we forget just how long that takes. And that means two things. One, it means that we can stand to be a little more patient, you know, when we really want to change someone's mind. We can stand to remember that the day you plant the seed isn't the day you eat the fruit. But the other thing is, you know, we can ask ourselves very serious questions about to whom do I owe that patience? You know, I mean, to get someone to really change their mind requires such a deep understanding of who they are and why they think what they think. There are very legitimate cases where you might want to think, that's not my job and that's not my duty and I don't owe that kind of personal care to this particular person. And so it's a hard call to work out which cases sit on which side of the line. But I think understanding how complex these things are and starting by examining stories where it's gone right, I hope that that's some way that we can find a blueprint that will be useful.
I think readers will be buoyed by the things that happen to the people in the book, although perhaps not wishing for the same sort of things to happen to them. The book is called Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. It's the work of Eleanor Gordon Smith, philosopher, broadcaster, writer. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.